This is Luke Allison with Critical.com, and today I'm here with Chad Smith. Chad, how are you?
Doing pretty well, Luke. How about yourself?
Hanging in there, man. I want to kind of set a background for people that might not be familiar with you or sort of track and field in general, but okay. You had a successful throwing career, and I want to kind of get into that wherever you think is the right place to start.
Okay. Well, out of high school, I went to the University of California, Berkeley, on a scholarship. Things kind of didn't pan out for me there. I was then out of track from basically January 2006 to December 2007, and then came back in the 2008 season. And kind of a pretty rough year, the first year back, you know, after almost 2 years off of training. And then in 2009, won two NAIA national championships, both indoor and outdoor title in the shot put, and was ranked as high as 12th at one point during the year, but finished up at 17th. In the U.S. in the shot put, and third among all American collegiates. When I threw 63 feet 10 and a quarter inches, and then competed as an open athlete in 2010. But kind of got to the point there where I was so busy with my business, Juggernaut Training Systems, that I couldn't really put the time towards it that I wanted, so I decided to retire from track at that point, which, so I was 23, and I'd been competing in track since I was 9. That was kind of a tough deal. And then turned my efforts towards powerlifting, which has brought us to this point.
And definitely some things that I want to touch on. The track background is sort of interesting. You have an implement, you're sort of manipulating the implement, and that kind of attracts, you know, different people, and it requires different things. Can you talk sort of how that influenced some of your training, possibly?
Yeah, you know, throwers in track and field, I think a lot of outsiders will be like, oh, you just have to be like a big, strong guy or whatever. They're not good athletes, but the people who are, you know, the top-level track and field athletes, the throwers, they're as big as the biggest football players, stronger, as strong as the strongest weightlifters, and, you know, some of the most explosive athletes on the planet. Like, my senior year of track, I had a 35-inch vertical. I weighed 290 pounds, and I could dunk a medicine ball, like a 8-pound medicine ball. I was 6 foot, 290. You know, in training, I've taken a lot of those concepts from track and field and brought them to the training of all the athletes I really work with. Because, you know, in my exposure to track and field and the throws and the sprints, it's, you know, you have people who run the fastest, who jump the highest, and who throw the furthest, and just take those training concepts and apply them to a basketball player, a football player, you know, train my skill guys like sprinters and my linemen like throwers, you know, as a pretty good recipe for success to have a big, strong, explosive athlete.
Certainly true. I think it's Bondarchuk who had, you know, the idea or put the idea out there that it's not necessarily the strongest thrower who makes the best thrower.
Yeah, you know, Bondarchuk has done a lot of stuff. He coached Yuri Sadik and Sergei Litvinov, the two greatest hammer throwers of all time, and did a lot of research and stuff about how, you know, Sadik got weaker in the general lifts, the squat, clean, and snatch for him, but stronger in the specific exercises, like throwing different weighted hammers and some other unique exercises, and his throw continued to go up. And, you know, it's things that I experimented with to a degree, as far as throwing different weighted shot puts and things like that. But at least for me, I never had a good enough grasp on really what Bondarchuk's ideas were to go all in on them for myself. I kind of felt like, you know, if I don't really hit the nail on the head with the specific strength that he's talking about, then I'm just going to end up being weaker and not having the specific strength, and that's obviously not a good recipe for success. But, you know, his ideas about dynamic correspondence and the transfer of training are great ideas and something that can be applied, you know, across the board, regardless of what sport you have. And that, when the term sport specific, you know, in my industry of training athletes, gets thrown around so much and misused by such a large portion of the population. But Bondarchuk's ideas about, you know, sport specific strength and dynamic correspondence are really, really what people should be aiming for there.
I would agree. I think it seemed like something worth mentioning simply because some of the athletes you work with do seem to come from skill-intensive sports, which is sort of what your background was. I thought that was an interesting parallel.
I think one of the toughest things to manage when dealing with an athlete, especially like volleyball players and water polo players, are two of the biggest populations that I train here in Southern, you know, like hotbed for those sports in Southern California here. And, you know, it's not really lifting weights and strength training is not really a part of those sports cultures like it is for football or wrestling or something like that. And they are much more skill-driven sports, I think, than some others. So, like, how you manage the like, bioenergy demands that you're putting on them, because, you know, I'm really strong, but I can't play. I have no appreciable water polo skills, so obviously being really strong doesn't make you a good water polo player, because I'm not a good water polo player. So how do you balance, you know, their skill development there and then being strong in the water and doing different drills like egg beatering with holding med balls out of the water and things like that with their general strength development in the weight room. And I think that goes back to Bondarchuk, you know, is where you bridge, how you can bridge that gap from the weight room to the pool, the weight room to the court, or with basketball players, you know, another really skill-intensive thing. So
I just thought it was interesting. I wasn't sure how far to push that sort of discussion, but it, you know, it seemed like a more beneficial background than I think what a lot of people come from typically in the United States. So I wanted to sort of explore that a bit. But you've made sort of an interesting transition recently. You did a raw powerlifting meet last fall, I believe. What was the total? I think it was 1963. What was that experience like for you?
You know, it was interesting. I kind of decided once I left track last May or June of 2009, of 2010, that I still wanted to compete at something. And, you know, I was already lifting really hard for track and was strong. Figured the natural transition, and as I was already sponsored by Elite Fitness as well, was to compete in a meet. So I just kind of laid out a plan to get ready for this meet, which became that plan is the Juggernaut Method, which I'm sure we'll talk about more, to get ready for it. And it was an interesting experience because you got about 10 seconds, you know, that these, or 15 seconds that these nine lifts are going to take. And I had 20 weeks building into this. And it's kind of like a track meet, because with the track meet stuff, I would spend all this time to get, you know, one throw right, really. I mean, it'd be nice to have all six throws right, but I just needed one. I only needed one to be right. And I had spent hundreds of hours, you know, thousands of hours preparing for something that was going to take a second and a half. So that, I think it kind of prepared me my track background had prepared me well for that, as far as being able to perform, you know, when the bright lights are on and you're up. But it was a small meet, which was nice. I think that was a good place to start, and it was fun. And I made all my goals going into it. I had said in June that I wanted to squat 8 and pull 7 and bench 455, and I ended up benching 463 at it. So, you know, I went 7 for 8. I passed on my last deadlift and missed one squat, but it couldn't have really gone too much better. So,
and is that something you plan to continue in the future? Just sort of isolate meets and sort of, you know, train up to them, or what is your thought about that moving forward?
Yeah, I'm gonna definitely continue to compete. My next meet is March 5th, the SPF Ironman, the Pro-Am out in Tennessee. I want to go 21:50 at that meet in the 308s weight class, which is, you know, will be one of the two or three biggest totals for a 308s in the last couple of years. It's going to be a way bigger meet, you know. The American record holder in the squat, Troy Nash, for my weight class, is going to be competing at it. Robert Wilkerson, who's the super heavyweight world record holder in the squat, is going to be competing at it. And then they have all the pro guys in the multiply gear the next day. Westside's going to be there. Big Iron guys are going to be there. So it's going to be a lot different than my little meet in the San Luis Obispo High School gym that I was at in October. But, you know, I want to keep competing. I don't see myself competing more than two or three times a year, just because being so busy running the business, you know, when I do something, I want to put everything I can into it. So getting ready for these meets is kind of an all-consuming process at a lot of points. Thankfully, I'm in a deload week this week, so it'll be decompressing. But yeah, I don't see myself competing more than two or three times a year. But yeah, I've got some big aspirations in powerlifting. So I'll definitely be continuing to compete there.
I want to see if I can try to smash two ideas together. I want to ask sort of about your preparation and the development of the Juggernaut system, but also see if you can work in the idea of only competing two or three times a year, because that begins to sound like a season, like track, like other sports, whereas a lot of the philosophy for powerlifting is there are meets all the time. Can stay above 90% all year long, and you don't need to break. And it's very sort of contrasting ideas.
Okay. Well, the Juggernaut method, you know, came out of an idea or of some training cycles that I was using with the athletes at my place, Juggernaut Training Systems. That, you know, it was a very basic cycle where the first week they would do 5 sets of 5. At a manageable weight, like 75%. In the second week, they'd ramp it up a little bit and do 3 sets of 5 at 80%. And then the third week, I was having them do a 5 rep max, you know, which for me is usually going to fall about 85%. And so I was having these athletes do it, and they're making good progress, and, you know, they'd get that 85% for 5, no problem, and then maybe I'd have them go, you know, 20 pounds up from there, and, you know, they're usually getting that for 5. So I had a little break between my indoor and outdoor track seasons. I was like, all right, let me see how this works for me. So go in and with the squat, let's say I squatted 455 for 5 sets of 5 the first week, and then went to 495 for 3 sets of 5 the second week, and the third week of the wave, so I had like 550 for 5. And as soon as I racked it, I thought to myself, man, that was easy. I should have done it for more. I shouldn't have racked it. So that kind of sparked my mind on the idea of taking like a rep max the last week, or, you know, that weight to near failure at 85% in this case, to near failure, and also driving the progress of your plan from phase to phase through that rep max, which is an idea I took from Doug Young, who's a great powerlifter in the 70s, great bench presser, incredible physique, and his all his training was based around these limit sets, as he called them, that he would do every week and adjust his weights based off of that. So the juggernaut method, you know, just came from that. It really was like a light bulb hit, and lightning struck me as soon as I racked that fifth rep with 550, and it just kind of got the wheels turning, and it grew from this, you know, one little 3 week thing out to a whole 16 week training cycle. As far as competing two or three times a year, you know, like I said, for me doing that, I'm doing that because of the demands of my business. And if I'm in smashing it every week at above 90%, it's so taxing to the CNS for me when I work a 14-hour day, you know, of a very active job where I got to be on and demonstrating things to people, that it makes recovery too difficult for me. But for other athletes, you know, I think they're better off to compete less and do more submaximal training, because it's so much easier on the body as far as not getting injured. And when you're dealing with a drug-free lifter, I don't think that they can't stay up at 90% for weeks and months on end. I mean, even if they're taking a deload every fourth week or something, and it not break them down physically and mentally. At the same time, with that being said, I know Louis, you know, I think talks the most about staying above 90%, and that his guys are always ready for a meet. And Louis will talk so much about GPP and the lifter, you know, having that high level of conditioning. I think that is something important as well. Just because I'm going to compete only three times in 2011, probably, that doesn't mean that when I'm 20 weeks out for a meet that I'm going to be weak, you know, or I'm not going to be, that I wouldn't be ready to compete. I'm just going to focus my training a little bit differently, and I can take, you know, a month and maybe do some more bodybuilding kind of stuff and try and put on some size or really put a lot of focus towards something I identify as a weak point.
I think it was just interesting. It seemed like a credible alternative. You know, it's just this idea that, you know, there's this one way to powerlift and there's this one way to train. And I just thought it was interesting, you know, the way that you sort of moved away from that and then are really looking at a very serious meet with very strong people coming up in a couple months. So,
yeah, and I mean, another reason why, besides my, you know, my commitment to my business, that makes me only want to train two or three times or compete two or three times a year, is that it will allow me to do other things in the strength sports world, which I have aspirations to do, like Highland Games, like Strongman. You know, if I have 20 weeks between meets, if I want to take the first 8 weeks of that and kind of focus it towards doing a Highland Games, you know, I can do that and then have a 12-week cycle into the next meet. And that is my goal. John Cole, who's the world record holder for the total at my weight class 308s, told 2364 in 1972. And that's my goal, is to break that total. But John Cole was not just a great powerlifter. He was national champion in the discus throw, and he was a serious contender to make the U.S. Olympic team in Olympic lifting, you know. And there's a lot more guys like that in the 60s and 70s. You know, George Friend was world record holder in the weight throw and squatted like 840 at 242s, and Kazmaier, who, you know, great strongman, great powerlifter, pretty good in the Highland Games as well. Guys who are just so well-rounded in their strength, and they could do everything, and that's, you know, that's what I aspire to be, is not just to be a great powerlifter or a great shot putter or a great Olympic lifter or whatever your field is, grounded you can be. You know, that's just being a strong man. You know, not a strong man competitor, but just an overall strong person and really an athlete. And that's what I never want to lose is I'm an athlete first and a lifter second. You know, I want to be able to go out and do anything. It's play pickup basketball games or squat 800 pounds. You know, people say you can't ride two horses with one ass or serve two masters at once, you know, and not to say that I'm going to try and do that, but I want to be well-rounded in my strength. So only competing in powerlifting two or three times a year will allow me to pursue some other related fields and I think be very successful in them as well.
No question that would be something to see, to bring back a renaissance like that with, you know, taper toss and weight for height and then people doing strongman and things like that. I mean, you know, if you're strong, you can do that. I don't know where the intense pressure to specialize comes from necessarily. Maybe you have some theories on that, but I don't know that it's good for everyone in every situation.
Sorry, what was the last part?
Just the over-specialization, the idea that I'm only going to throw, or I'm only going to power lift, or I'm only going to do Highland Games or things like that. Because like you were saying, in the 70s or the 60s, you know, that's not how it was. People did multiple sports.
A lot of people would make the argument that, well, if you want to be the absolute best at something, then you have to just focus on that. But and like I said, John Cole, he's got that 308 total world record been out there for since 1972, I mean, almost 40 years, and no one that I know of has really even approached that at 308s. And maybe he was just that good, you know, that, and he's the only person who can do that. But I'll be out there trying to prove people that say that wrong, you know, and hopefully, you know, be just as successful in Highland Games and strongman as I was in track, and as it would appear, I'm going to become in powerlifting. So,
right, it could be a trend, right? Probably not too big of a surprise if you did it. I remember reading, I think it was your meet write up after the powerlifting meet, after you deadlifted 700. You had some second thoughts or you know, wanting desires to improve on the deadlift. I think it was something to do with, like, a lack of familiarity. Is that right?
Yeah, you know, I only started training the deadlift when I began training for that last meet, so about June of 2010. And, you know, I never had anyone teach me how to deadlift. Like, at least I just kind of, you know, read articles on Elite and stuff and look at videos, and I know what it's supposed to look like, you know. I mean, I know how to teach it to an athlete, but having someone more qualified than myself watch me do it is a different ball game. So I'd say limited experience, and I've never missed a deadlift. I've never missed a deadlift since June of then till now, and I'm sure at some point I'm gonna miss one, you know. But I think when you're pulling heavy singles, there, Josh Bryant, he wrote an article talking about committing to the pull, you know, and that's something that I'm working with right now, is that idea of committing to the pull, because I'm looking to pull high sevens, maybe 800 at this meet in March, you know, close to 100-pound PR, and the idea of as soon as I get that bar in my hands, it's not coming out until it's locked out and I put it back on the ground, you know. And the pain and stuff that's associated with that is, you know, something I haven't experienced. So I'm trying to kind of wrap my mind around it. And Josh Bryant is actually who I've been working with going into this meet. He's been helping me with a lot with my programming, and I think, you know, really doing some good things for my deadlift. Like last week I pulled 700 for a double, pretty easily. So deadlift's really been on the move, and it's been a lot of work, but going well.
That's certainly, you know, something to remember, because I've talked to people before, you know, who played sports in college, competed on the national level in whatever their sport was, but they had a similar story where they didn't deadlift, or they had coaches that said, "Don't deadlift," and yet it's in powerlifting, and it's kind of hard to get away from. You know, that's
Yeah.
a weird
And a
sort
lot
of
of times,
element.
coming up through high school and my first couple of years and in college, I didn't deadlift because I didn't need to. No one was making me do it. And I would,
Right.
I w I've always been such a good squatter that I liked to squat, but I wasn't such a good, I didn't feel like I was as good a deadlifter, so I didn't like to deadlift, so I just didn't do it. I just squatted instead. And, you know, we do the Olympic lifts and stuff my first couple of years in school, and we do a little bit of deadlifting then, but nothing, you know, nothing too drastic. So until it got to the point where there was no other option besides either get good at deadlift or embarrass myself by not being good at it when I gotta do it in front of a bunch of people, you know,
Right.
that's the first time I was like, well, time to learn how to deadlift.
Specific demands and
Yeah.
whatnot. We've talked about your gym that you recently opened. I want to give you a chance to sort of talk about that, talk about what you have in there and sort of who you're working with right now.
My gym, Juggernaut Training Systems, in Laguna Hills, California, and we opened in September 2009. Myself and named Nathan Winkler run it. Nate was a college basketball player, a point guard, and then became a sprinter after that. And you know, we work with athletes of all ages, from, you know, junior high kids up to NFL guys and MMA guys and people who make their living playing sports. And as far as, it's a 6,000 square foot facility broken up into like half turf and half weight room, all elite FTS equipment. Pretty much anything you could have, we got it. You know, great power racks, competition benches, tires, hammers, prowlers, sleds, ropes, reverse hyper, GHR. The list is pretty extensive as far as our equipment goes. I mean, the bulk of our clientele is high school and college athletes, and surprisingly, it's like I said, volleyball players and water polo players, which, you know, my background is certainly not that, but you know, after some critical thinking, it's not too hard to figure out what they need to be successful. But I think some of the more notable athletes I work with are in jiu-jitsu. Romelu Barral is probably my poster child. He's a six-time world champion at his weight class and three-time runner-up in the open weight class. So hopefully this is going to be the year where he brings home that open weight class title, and I can have a hand in that.
Very nice. I know just because of the popularity of mixed martial arts and jiu-jitsu, it's something that a lot of people think that they can train. But what do you sort of observe from a strength and conditioning perspective when you watch a jiu-jitsu match or when you watch an MMA fight?
You know, I think a lot of people, they see videos of MMA guys and jiu-jitsu guys training on YouTube and stuff, and they think that all they do are these like balls out circuits where they're going to be puking at the end, and they think, well, MMA fighters are tough, so their training has to be really tough. And that's just not correct, because yeah, their training is really tough. Like, Romelu trains about 18 times a week, like 18 sessions a week, between three
That's a
times
lot.
with me, like 10 to 12 jiu-jitsu sessions, and then he's looking to break into MMA as well, so doing some boxing and some wrestling and some Muay Thai classes here and there, or some Muay Thai training here and there. That you know, his body is beaten up. Like, I don't need to add to that by having him do all these really hard conditioning circuits. And yeah, they look cool to put on videos, and there are times when we do them, but really the bulk of my guys' training is focused around very basic exercises that they don't need to take a lot of time to learn how to do because their sport is not powerlifting. It's not Olympic lifting. So I'm not going to waste their time making them, you know, the best, have the best clean and jerk technique ever because they don't need to do that. You know, they need to have strong, they need to have like, they need to have strong legs. They don't need to be a great squatter. So we're trying to do as little as possible to get the desired result. So they actually do a lot of training that would be similar to what a track and field athlete would do. They sprint, they jump, they squat and deadlift, they bench and pull up. And then, you know, we do some specific work as far as they need a lot of grip strength. They need a lot of, to be a lot of hip extension strength. So we do get sports specific, and I don't like to use that term in those couple of small areas, but strength becomes sport specific when it's practiced. You know, they're going to get strong with me and they're going to transfer that when they go and roll and they get on the mat, you know, and they learn how to use that newfound strength through their technique and use it efficiently. And there are times when you can go on our YouTube channel and see them flip tires and swing the sledgehammer and all that kind of stuff because there are times that we do that. But I think so many people see those and think, okay, that's what he does all the time, you know, and then you get great at doing circuits, but you're weak, and, you know, being weak is never a good thing to be. So.
Right. Certainly never ideal, obviously.
Yeah.
One of the trends, just because you're in sort of that specific world, there's been a trend in the UFC to have Martin Rooney or Jonathan Chamberg, you know, essentially a fighter's strength and conditioning coach, in their corner, involved in game planning. Is that something that you see continuing or something that you're sort of involved in any way?
You know, that's not something that I'm involved in. You know, Martin, I think, is a brown belt in jiu-jitsu and has a martial arts background that I do not have. So putting him in there would be a totally different thing. I felt like if I get to walk down to the octagon or something with one of my guys one day, that's just going to be a thing like, you know, thanks for getting me ready. You get a really good seat to watch this. But, I mean, I would never see myself, you know, helping with the game planning of that. You know, there are people who that's their expertise, and I'm going to leave that to them, and hopefully they realize that this is my expertise, and they don't tell me how to do my job because...
I understand. I was probably fishing a bit too much. It just seemed like, you know, fighters are going to have ways that they fight that don't match up with other people quite as well, not to sort of talk about fighting here, but that would impact strength and conditioning. You know, that sort of fight camp. It would obviously be different if you're trying to do different things, but possibly not so much, I guess. I don't know. Did we miss anything? I've definitely taken up about a half hour of your time. I didn't mean to do that.
I got time. I'm not too busy in the middle of the days, but I mean, that's the only thing that I would say is to buy the Juggernaut Method ebook. You know, if any athlete, any speed and power athlete, you know, if being stronger, faster, more explosive, and in better condition is going to help you succeed at your sport more, which, you know, that will help in pretty much every sport. That's a program that's going to be able to help them, do that. You know, it's proven through my 800-pound raw squat that it's going to get you strong. I got dozens and dozens of athletes who it's put inches on their vertical, taking tenths off their 40, and that's available at elitefts.com, and that's and at my website jtsstrength.com, and it's a really good program. It's very well thought out. I mean, at least I think it is. So, yeah.
I'm telling people to go get it too, because I want to see how you do later this spring, and certainly keep tabs on you and see how things progress.
Yeah, thank you.
All right, take care, and I definitely appreciate it. Thank you again.
All right, yeah, if you got anything else, you know where to reach me.
All right, I appreciate it. Thanks, Jen.
Right. Thanks a lot, Luke.